And I have a great show today. You know, I haven't been really doing my little comedy segments anymore because I just don't feel like doing it, people. You know, I just don't feel like sitting there talking about it. I do want to say, though, but last night I felt like I had to wash my brain because someone talked about the show Honey Boo Boo, and I actually watched a few minutes of it. And how this is a hit, it disgusts me. I mean, our country is so bad. How can you look at someone who lives in America, who is born and bred in America, but yet when they talk English, there's subtitles? I can understand, like, gangland, they're in the streets, you know, they're tough, because they always subtitle the guys in gangland. It's like, you know, which gangland always cracks me up, because they always have, like, the guy disguised, like, the criminal who's in the Crips, but his name's, like, Jojo Bokachoy, which, they're like, there's no other Jojo Bokachoys in the Crips, so they know who he is. But I can see them when they do their thing, but subtitles, the whole show was subtitles on Honey Boo Boo, and it was on for, like, 3 hours straight, and I swear to God, I watched it, and my brain felt violated, okay? So I don't even have hair. I use a lot of shampoo just to see if it would seep into my brain. So anyway, we have a great show. We're going to talk with someone who's actually a very good comedy writer. And I know you started off doing comedy, right?
Yeah, I started off doing stand-up.
And his name is Kevin Rooney. Kevin Rooney, how are you?
Good, Steve. How are you?
Good. I'm glad to have
Thanks
you.
Thanks for having me down, man.
So where are you from originally? Are you on the East Coast? Or?
Yeah, New Hampshire.
Okay.
Born in New Hampshire, and then my father was working as a teacher in a small girls' college there. So he wanted out, and we left when I was about two.
Okay.
Just before I was two. I was there for a year, maybe, with the one picture of me as a one-year-old in 1950 is standing in a snowbank, you know, with a little snowsuit on.
Right, yeah, I had that.
Enraged my face. I'm just startled and, like, enraged, like, what?
It's so funny when you first, like, it's now, it's like, if I saw snow now, I just always, like, I remember, like, when your dog would see snow for the first time.
Yeah.
They'd be in awe. Like, as a kid, you're scared crapless of it because you're sitting there going, what is this stuff? Like,
not only that, I was born in November, so the snow was, it was snow.
Okay.
So my impression when I come out is it's snow.
Okay.
I live in a snow world. There's no, I don't know that summer's coming.
You're in a snow globe. You're one of those kids in a snow globe.
I'm just there. I'm looking around in the snowbank as a kid. They're like, this is what? This is it? This is where I live? I come from the womb. It's nice. I come here. So then we moved to California for a little bit back then, all over, you know, Pennsylvania, Rochester, New York, Ithaca, New York, all over in the New England, upper New York State area, back to California and Sunnyvale before there was a Silicon Valley, before I could become rich.
Right.
But then out to Boston, and then, you know, high school in Boston, I kind of peripatetic from that point until came out here about 30 years ago.
Now, did your family follow comedy, or did they watch it? I mean, how did you know you wanted to get into comedy?
I had no idea about comedy. It wasn't like, you know, I always envy my New York friends and some of the, you know, big city guys, because they knew about stand-up.
Right.
As a job. You know, I would watch it with my father. You'd watch the Ed Sullivan show.
Right.
So, I mean, I'd see somebody funny. I just thought he was a guy like my dad who always told jokes and was funny. He was some guy who had a job. But, you know, they would go and do the Ed Sullivan show. But that was it.
Okay.
There was no world of stand-up. There were no clubs. It wasn't a job. It wasn't something you could do. It was like a hobby, and they brought you on, like the girl with the, you know, like the person on Carson with the potato chips. You know, one looks like Lincoln. She's got the entire presidential potato chip set. So it's like that. So I didn't know about it.
Okay, so.
And I didn't study it. I didn't think about it. My father was an editor and a reader, so I was an English guy. I like to read.
Okay.
I like to read novels, like to read books, was an English major. And so my aspirations were always to write like, you know, like Mark Twain.
Or
J.D. Salinger or somebody like that. That would
be the great American novelist.
My focus was that.
Okay.
And then I drifted into stand-up because I'm really lazy. And once I knew about it when I was about 30 in Washington, D.C., working there was a stand-up club there in D.C., a white country western bar in the middle of Anacostia, which was all black.
That's, okay.
You know, and we would go over there. And that's where I first started doing some stand-up. And I was lucky I got some laughs the first night, because I always thought if I hadn't gotten laughs the first night, I never would have done it again.
What were you, what were you doing as your job at that time? Were you
at that time? I was just I had been in the Army. So when I got out of the Army and came back, I was doing all manner of, you know, working at a ski area, working at a bartender, working as a busboy or dishwasher. And at that point, I was down in D.C. I had hurt my back, blew my back out up in Vermont, working. And I went down to Washington where my folks were at that time.
Okay.
Just hang out. And I got a job when I could move around at the Museum of History and Technology, or whatever it was, science history, at the mall there.
Okay.
In D.C. So I was doing that, working in a bookstore.
So you were sitting there. So you started doing comedy. Now, you got laughs your first time, which I think that is very important. Because I know I got laughs my first time. And then my second time, I didn't get laughs. I didn't show up for like a month. And the thing is, it's me. And I was just out of college. I was 22 or 23. And it's like, you look back at it now, and you do that first set, and you get some laughs. And you think the club owner's going to come and book you. And you're going to like, hey, man, I'm going to be. And then you sit there and go realistic on it. That was one night in front of 8 drunk people in the Comedy Factory outlet in Philadelphia. And you know what? And then you go back the next week, and you just eat it. And then you go, like, it's like this hurt. And it's like, but you don't know. You're, when you're young, you think, oh, my God, I'm going to be, this is it. Oh, Hollywood, they're going to call me. And it's like you did 5 minutes of crappy jokes. That's for me.
Just,
I'm like,
I didn't even have an idea of it as a career.
Okay.
It was just an easy way to get a response to something I thought or said.
Okay.
That was the whole thing about writing or anything else. It's just a way to, you know, all these little voices, like when, you know, we're on Facebook or Twitter, all these voices are struggling to be heard and, you know, crying out, not for ratification. You know, it's a really, it's a great thing to have someone give you that little like.
Right.
I know there are people who don't get likes.
I know. I worry
about those people because they just, after a while, they give up and they shut down. They're quiet. But to get one, to get a laugh, it's like so it wasn't a career. It wasn't like I'm going to make money.
Okay.
I had no idea that people made money. I mean, I'm really kind of stupid about that. I don't pay any attention to what's going on or think about it.
Right.
I was just doing it, and you get a laugh, and that is like crack. That's instantly addictive, getting laughs from an audience. So you could bomb the next night, but you're not going to forget the high of that laugh. So you do go back, and that was in the 80s. That was the beginning. That was 79, 80. So that's the beginning of the comedy boom. So from that point, just being there with a few things to say, if you were moderately funny, and I used to be moderately funny, you could show up, and the rise in the comedy business could carry you up.
That was
like a bubble in a soda can. So you could get stage time pretty easily. You could get to be an opener, or an MC, or a middle act, you know, and then you're just gathering together stuff.
Now, you started. Were you staying in D.C. at that time?
At that time, but I moved from there pretty quickly. I was only there at that spot for a few months, and I decided to go back on the GI Bill to University of Massachusetts.
So
it's easy to be on the GI Bill.
Right, okay.
All you got to do is find an apartment that's half of that, and you know, you can live, read books, lounge around.
Okay.
I didn't bother with the classes or try and get a degree, and it was not aiming towards anything.
Okay.
I did get certified to teach at one point, finally, but I never did.
Okay.
And it was just fun to go back up on the GI Bill.
So you went to Boston now, then that's, I mean, Boston
Amherst,
was such
out,
a...
out in this country, out in Amherst, out in the Happy Valley.
Now, did you start going to the Boston comedy clubs? Because there was such a great scene there.
You know what? I never did. I actually started a comedy club at the University of Massachusetts out in Amherst.
Okay.
Because I was working as a bartender in the you know, the university bar system there,
right.
The restaurant bar. And there was a room on the top of the campus. They had a 25-story tower there. And on the top, there was an open room.
Okay.
Basic, a function room. And I said, why don't we try a comedy show? So I put an ad in the paper. You know, are you funny? You want to do a comedy? And I got like 4 responses. And I always thought this was interesting. That was 1980. And the responses were Jack Gallagher, who's still, I don't know if you know Jack Gallagher.
I know, I know the name.
He plays a doctor often on Curb and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And he lives in this... where's he? Up in Sacramento now.
Okay.
And he's still in the business. He's a very funny guy. Did a lot of one-man shows. He responded. Mike Ivey, who's still working. You know Mike. Ken Ober, who passed away about a year or two ago. He was a responder. And Peter Tolan. So all those people that just on that little ad showed up for one night to see if they, you know, they're still in the business many years later. I just thought that was kind of remarkable.
And it's weird also because it's like it wasn't, as you said, it was in Amherst. It wasn't in Boston. You know, so, but there was, I mean, that's like anyone's looking. I mean, if it's near a city, because some people are like, I don't want to drive an hour. I don't know, how far is Amherst from Boston? I don't know.
2 hours.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to drive 2 hours to wait in line and maybe not get on stage. You know, it's like, we need someplace close.
And I didn't even know what they, like, once again, I didn't say to somebody, hey, you know, I'm never one of these guys. I didn't have headshots. I didn't have business cards. I didn't have special outfit. It was just like getting up on stage, telling some jokes. And I guess there was some notion of, I'm not a comic. I'm a writer. I'm going to do that. Well, I never did. But at the time, I didn't say to them, hey, wait, this is fun. Are there clubs in Boston? We could make a weekend trip. And I never thought of that.
Okay.
So we were doing some stand-up there at season that school year ended. And I went to New York.
Okay.
And then I ran into some people I'd known in Washington, Rich Scheidner.
And Rich has been on the show. He's from New Jersey.
Yeah, he's great. South Jersey. And Ron Zimmerman, I don't know if you know Ron.
The name sounds familiar.
So I hooked up with Richie there, and he got me a job at the door of the Improv.
Okay.
But I still wasn't angling towards being a stand-up.
Just being around it.
Being around it and telling some jokes and maybe pick up a little cash. Or
right.
A good job and be able to just write, which I, like I said, I never did. Too lazy. Or don't have the talent, one or the other. I'm starting to come up. At 61, I'm starting to go, I just think I probably didn't have it in me. but I was working there. And then that was also at the beginning of the comedy book.
Right.
So there was time, like late at night, 3, 4 in the morning, when I could go up and get some stage time if I wanted to, or on a weekend. And then that just led into a career in it. Just by showing up and doing a few jokes, there were opportunities.
Now, were you going out on the road, or were you just staying in New York? Or
started going out on the road there a little bit in 81, I guess, okay. When I was going 82. Then I came out here because I took an evening at the Improv when that show was something to watch, and did that out here. And then the Merv Griffin show, when that was on there, did that. And then I got the Tonight Show in 85, so I started doing the Tonight Show and some things, and that led to a lot more road work.
Now, it's so funny because you talk about Merv Griffin, and I remember, like, you talk about the kids now that don't know what talk shows are, you know, and it's like, for me, it's like, when we were little, you know, because I'm 47, we would sit there and Mike Douglas. We'd always watch Mike Douglas, and
right.
it was shot in Philadelphia in the beginning, so that was a big thing. We were 10 minutes from Philly. My parents were from Philly. But now it's like, people don't have a clue. Like, there was such just classic, like, even like the old Tonight Shows, it was just like, Johnny is so good, and just like, sometimes stars would show up in the middle of the afternoon, like drunk, like the guys from F Troop would just walk on,
right.
And he loved that stuff.
Right.
What was it like doing, how long have you been doing stand-up comedy when you did the Tonight Show?
About 5 years.
Okay.
So, everything then, it's so hard to think back and put yourself back
right.
in what technologically the world was in 1985, because it doesn't sound that far. You know, I still look and see a car for sale in 1990 something. I'll think, well, that's like a brand new car.
Right.
But, it, you know.
Exactly. Well, honestly, I think of computers. Totally. I think of my computers in college. I mean, I graduated college in 86.
Right.
It was like, wait a second. Wow, what are these things? These things. And now I go, if I had a child and they said, oh, we couldn't get a term paper or a book report done, I would just bitching him, because I'm like, you have the computer. We had to go with the Dewey Decimal System. We didn't have an internet.
No.
People don't get that. I tell comics, I go, we didn't have links. We'd put a little package together with our tape and our headshot and mail it. And if you didn't get booked, you lost $5 each time.
Right. And you had to go to the library to find things if you wanted
right.
to. You couldn't just, you know, you'd have arguments that would last forever because there was no way to settle them.
I know, it's like, can't be in a bar going,
oh, no, he hit 350. No, I hit 304 that year. You can't just go, oh, I'll check my watch. My watch will tell me. He'll give me a picture of him, too. But back in 1985, there was no late night. There were a few shows.
Right.
So when you were doing the Tonight Show, that was it. That was a big audience. It was, you know, it was really the show to do. So when you got the Tonight Show, that was a big moment, a big make or break feeling.
Right.
So the first time, I remember doing that first time, you're just excited, you know, you're excited about it. I was nervous. And the guy, there's a stagehand there ready to pull the curtain back. You know, they would play you on and that Tonight Show curtain open up. And
right.
They, you know, if you're home watching, the curtain opens and the bull comes out. And
right, yeah.
Right. So they open, look at the guy. And he's just standing there. He couldn't be less interested.
Okay.
You know, and I realized, this is no big, huge thing. This guy lets people out of this curtain every night.
Right.
And he couldn't care. He's not worried. He doesn't think I'm going to go out there and get killed or gored.
Yeah.
Or
that's a good way to look at it. Because, it's like with flying. It's like, because my girlfriend lives back east, I go back once a month. I used to hate flying. And my roommate from college is a pilot. And he's like, safer than driving.
Right.
And I figured out the reason I hated flying was I would always stress out on if I forget something when I fly. It's like, well, if I forget something, I'm not going to a third world country. There's a mall. I can buy a pair of shoes. A little native doesn't have to skin like an elephant or make a belt out of a tusk.
Right.
You know, that you can, and that's when I got over that. I said, hell with it. I have a shuttle pick me up, get on a plane, and skip.
It's not like going to Australia in 1810.
Right.
On a boat.
Exactly.
You left something behind. That was it.
Yeah.
We're never going to see that thing again. You know, that is the flying thing always, because I flew so much when I was a stand-up. And, you know, I fly, I do some flying now, you know, back and forth to Europe. And I'm a little more nervous about it now. And you know, I don't know, I don't really know why, but I don't like turbulence. It didn't really ever bother me.
Okay.
And I always used to laugh at these people. They'd get off the plane, and they would be, you know, we'd be on our way down to get baggage, and you hear people going, "Oh God, I'm so glad we made it. I was so scared, a little turbulence there." And I think, now they're all, "Oh my God, we're so thankful." The safest part of the trip is over. Now they get into a little blue van.
Exactly. Yeah,
driven by an ex-Taliban warlord who's got a jacket with so much dirt on it, he could be a garden. He's like at the end of a 27-hour shift. He's on every pill imaginable. The doors are twined shut. And they're just riding along there, you know. And the most dangerous part of the trip.
I know, what's funny also is I always crack up when I always crack up when people like go crazy to get on a plane. It's like it's not, I don't fly Southwest. There's assigned seating. And right. It's like everyone's like, "Oh, they all get up." And I'm like, I'd rather be out here than on the plane right now. Because I always figure also is, you know what? I don't mind. I can't bring a carry-on. If they say there's no room, we're going to check your bag, I don't mind. Because if you're layover, it doesn't mean you have to lug that crap around.
Right.
That's the thing. And then when you land, they're in such a rush to get up. You can't go anywhere. There's 80 people in front of you,
exactly.
And they all go crazy, and they're standing. I'm like, and you can't stand because of things. I'm just like, you people, it's crazy.
Yeah, everybody's hunched under that ledge, and they're all leaning on the seat in front of them. They can't wait to get out, and very, you know, you get the people who don't understand the etiquette of, you got to let the row in front of you empty out.
They'll try
and push forward a little bit, or, you know, the people who get on and put their baggage in the first overhead rack.
And they're sitting in the very back. And you're like, what the hell is that crap?
You take your bag. It's always some slob. Take your bag.
I love that term, slob.
It's just mixing in with humanity that gets to be a drag. But now you go, there's nothing you can do. You're going to go in. You're going to sit in that little seat. You know, you're going to sit in there for however many hours. You know, on these trips when you go overseas, you know, these 9-10 hour flights.
Right.
It's murder. You know, that last 3 hours of a 12-hour flight is just some kind of psychological torture, but there's nothing you can do.
Right.
You just have to get some kind of, I always love these guys, like some Zen thing, we go, just relax. We go, I understand that. I understand accepting the thing that's happening, but I still don't accept it because it's painful now. Now it's hurting me.
Yeah, and it's like, I can relax, but I don't remember. If I relax for 9 hours, I'm sleeping. Okay, and I can't, I took the red eye last week. I flew September 11th. Okay,
right. Yeah.
People are like, "What are you doing? You're crazy." I said, "Well, first of all, I said, I'm leaving LA at 9:50. So it's already September 12th back east.
Right.
So I'm safe."
Yeah.
And I get there, and I swear to God, the shuttle picks me up. I get this $20 shuttle. It usually makes like seven stops, but I usually fly early. I'm not going to have my friends take me at 5 in the morning.
Right.
But this was an evening flight. I was taking red eye, and it was supposed to leave at 9:50 or whatever. The guy picks me up. He goes, "Oh, you're my only passenger this time."
Yeah.
So we get there, and I get up, and there's no, I mean, it's LAX, and he pulls right up.
Mm-hmm.
I get off. I don't even wait in line for security. I don't even have to not even wait. I just walk right up. There's 30 TSA agents just standing around, and I'm like, this is the best time to ever fly. The plane was one-third full.
Right.
So it's just crazy.
That's my theory on living well, is you have to, you know, in basketball, when you wrong foot somebody.
Right.
You know, they're going this way, you go that.
Yeah.
So you have to do that in every aspect of your life. You got to go shopping at 2 in the morning. You know, this time to go to Saint-Tropez is in February. It's beautiful.
Right.
There's no smog. You can see the Alps. The town's like 70% full. You can get into any restaurant. There's still enough people to make it fun and happening.
Right. But
you, in the summer, when the pinheads are there, when, you know, if Paris Hilton's there, that's when you don't want to go. You don't want to go when Diddy's there.
Right.
You're not going to get into anything because you're not Diddy. So, you know, you're not going to get into a restaurant.
Right.
You're going to pay triple once you get in. You're just going to be someone they're going to bring in, charge, you know, $10 for a coffee and throw it back into the street until somebody famous shows up. You can go. The hotels are cheaper. Everywhere that people go in a group, if you're smart, you know, when you're a kid, you always want to go where the group is.
Right.
If you're smart, you'll watch where the group goes and go there when they're not there.
Exactly.
Go there in the winter, not the summer.
Oh, yeah. So I did that when we went down to the beaches in New Jersey, and we went in June because June, it's still nice. It's still not really hot. Kids aren't out of school yet, so it's not all the kids running around the beaches. And the hotel rooms, it's like instead of 200 a night, it was like 80, and it's still the same damn room,
same room.
The weather's nice, and you can actually park on the street.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for all the, you know, some things you got to go on the way. Even a ski, you got to go to a certain
right.
But there are a lot of places that you can go that everybody wants to go to, where if you'll just wait 2 months, right. for 3 months on the other side of it. You'll get better weather a lot of times. You'll get great hotel deals. You'll get food, all of that stuff.
It's like clothes. You always get the clothes because out here it's always warm, but they have to get rid of the summer clothes. Yeah. So you can still wear the summer clothes in October or November. Sure. So I always wait. I'm like, if I need shorts, guys, fashion never changes, okay? Right. Except maybe pleated pants. But besides that, yeah. you'd be pretty much set. So I sit there and I'll go to Old Navy and I go, wow, all these bathing suits are $10 or all these, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm going to buy five of them.
Right.
Just instead of spending $50 on one, I'm getting five. I mean, exactly. It's just the way you do it. It's you have to think that way.
Yeah, especially as you get old, you know, everything's going to close in on you at some point.
Right.
You got to look forward and you go, might as well get in a few habits that are helpful. I remember going to one gig. Bud Friedman at the Improv used to have this gig in Fort Lauderdale. And it was a mob joint called the Sunrise or the Sunset Theater or something. And I worked down there with Jackie Vernon and Brad the tall
Garrett,
yeah. And this was a while ago, but I got there about 5 p.m. and I go to the hotel,
okay,
and the front desk, and I said, checking in, I go, what time's dinner? He says, dinner's over. I said, it's over, it's 5 o'clock. I go, it's over. You can, you know, get a snack in the machine or something. So yeah, I'm tired. I go to my room, and the room there's got a paramedic pull cord next to the bed and one next to the toilet. I'm thinking, this is a pretty fancy place.
Right.
It's all set up. Next morning I get up. It's a rest home. It's a nursing home. And it's the last stop nursing home. It's one of these condo deals where you put in the condo. When they die, they pull a lever. You go down a chute. The family comes, you know, and you're buried. The whole package.
It's all
so,
deal.
You know, they're all walking around. All these people are on walkers, you know, with the baseball caps that are too big for them. And I go into the guy and I said, is there a bus to town or something so I can get some food? Because that little kitchenette. He says, yeah, on Wednesday. So Wednesday, I go out to this little bus. It's got Senior Citizen Fun Bus printed on the side in funny letters, you know. And I get on the bus and there's a couple of people on there waiting. One's an old guy up front. He's about 90. And a couple of people in the back. And they're all just crashed in there. They look like ventriloquist dummies somebody left in the bus.
Right.
And I said to him, excuse me, sir, is this the bus to town? And he looks at me, he goes, this is the bus to shopping, the bus to town's on Thursday. He's all pissed off at me. So I get on the bus, we go to the shopping mall. And when I get off the bus, I can see people, normal people in the shopping mall,
right,
look at the bus and go, now there's an old guy who's kept himself in shape. Look at that. But I follow these old people around and you learn tricks. The dark tuna with good mayo is pretty good, and it's a lot cheaper than,
right,
you know, the plantains are kind of a banana. It's cheaper than the bananas. There's all kinds of cost-cutting maneuvers you have to make.
My parents like that. My dad is 87. My mom is 81. Uh-huh. And they go out to breakfast every day, mm-hmm, and they have their places where the specials are. Well, Tuesday, we go here because it's, you know, $2.99,
right,
and then the senior, and if we go here for dinner, mm-hmm, and they know, and that's like, I love it because that's me. I'm going somewhere. I'm like, you know, hey, I got a Groupon.
Yeah.
I've never been happier since we got Groupon and Living Social. I'm like, wow, wait. Yesterday, I got a $10 Shell card for $3. I was like, wow, that's great. It could be nothing I would use, but if it's
right,
like, so much, like 70% of them, like, well, I'll buy that. And I'll just leave it in my place. But I'm like, it's such a good deal.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I guess it's inevitable. It's coming. I do like, you know, you had a little bit of time there where you could be kind of go into a store. I mean, I had no money until I was 45,
okay,
probably. I mean, I was working stand-up and had some. But until I was 40 or so, probably, it was, you know, it's, you wouldn't go into a bookstore and just buy what you wanted.
Right.
Wouldn't go, now that's a nice coffee table book of aerial shots,
right,
of the archipelagos. You know what? I don't really care about the archipelagos, but that's a nice, I'll get it.
Right.
How much is it? I don't even care. It's $35. You buy it.
Right.
Those days, I never had days like, I mean, it was always used bookstores or hand me down, you know, get something from somebody. And then there was a brief period of time where you go into a bookstore and you get what you wanted. And I thought, now that's pretty good. That's probably for me the top of life, where you don't have to, you can go to a restaurant and you just order.
Right.
And you know, unless you're in Paris in some weird, where, you know, you have to watch out, where you don't want to, you know, all of a sudden by mistake order a $500 bottle of wine.
Right.
But mostly you go in, you don't have to ask if you can afford the meal.
Right.
And that's a nice little thing to go through I think, for a period of time.
Oh, yeah.
And I wish
great.
Everybody could do that, because it is like, oh, wow, it's like such a relief not to bring in your little coupons and
right.
have to look at the menu and ask and see a meal you'd really like, but that's $31.50 for that entree. And if I, you know, that's another thing, by the way, lunch is like half the price of dinner.
Right.
At every restaurant. And it's the same food.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I would really like to have the mushroom stuffed chicken, but I can't.
Right, right,
and
right.
And I see people going, do you want an entree? No. You know, if you take friends who are, you know, down on their luck out to dinner, you go, you want a salad or an entree? They go, no, it's all right. You go, you have to go, go on, have one.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
Eat it.
You know, yeah, it's my treat. You know, go ahead. So, you know, that's sad. That's a sad thing right now in this economy. You see people just...
it is.
Down to the point where they look, you see people look in a restaurant like, boy, would I like to go in there and get something to eat, but... I'll slide down the street, too. You know, when I was
right.
in college, you go, I get the big box of macaroni, some tuna fish.
Oh, yeah. You get so creative. You sit there and go, wow. And I know a guy who was like a wizard with ramen, but right. he wouldn't add the salty stuff because then it's right. so bad for you. But, oh, yeah, well, if you don't use that salt and if you do this, you can use it's sort of like a lo mein. I'm like, dude, it's nothing like lo mein. Do you just think it is? Or you sort of like, or just think like he make fried rice. My
right.
And he's like, yeah, you just put a cracked egg in it. It's just like fried rice. And I'm like,
just like
it's
it.
Nothing like fried rice.
It's like, you know, I realized when you get bread. Now, when I'm in France, fresh bread is a different proposition there. You know, people buy a little baguette or a little, you know, a baguette of some kind.
Right.
They eat it that day. So they're always buying fresh bread. People really don't get big bags of bread. And it's funny. People go, I'm going to get the fresh bread, a bag of it. You go, well, tomorrow it's going to be day-old bread.
Right, right.
You might as well go to the day-old bread place.
Exactly.
And buy that. Unless you're going to eat the whole loaf tonight. But you go buy the day-old bread.
It's funny.
By the time you get down to loaf for the slice 17, it's all going to be
it's old.
Difference. 16 days old
yeah,
or 15
I know, exactly,
days old.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
Difference?
So, okay, so let me ask you something. So you did the Tonight Show. You know, we were talking about you doing the Tonight Show. It was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after you did the Tonight Show, how did you foray into writing? I mean, I know you've written for a lot of TV shows. Were you meeting comics who were getting breaks, became friends with, and then
yeah.
some of them said they liked your wit and they liked your style? Or what made you do the bridge over into the writing? I mean, you were still doing stand-up.
I still imagined myself doing something like writing.
Okay.
Okay. And, you know, the thing that was happening as time goes by, the great thing that happens is the standards relax.
Okay.
Okay. Whatever you had to do to be a writer in 1950, you don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
To be a poet, to be a television writer, it's the standards have collapsed to the point where I could actually participate.
Okay.
So in 1980-something, I met Jay Leno, one of the first road gigs I did up in Boston. Well, you were talking about Boston earlier. I never did those clubs up there. I went to New York, and then I got a gig up opening a comedy club in Boston, opening for Jay Leno.
Okay.
So I met him, and he and I were from basically the same place in Massachusetts, 8 miles apart. I didn't know him before, but, you know, we had the same attitude and the same kind of rhythms, and he was an influential guy for me to meet in the way he worked his jokes and the way he built his act.
Right.
But I liked him, and I started writing jokes for him.
Okay.
And in his early Letterman years, I wrote a lot of stuff for him. And then when he did a special for Showtime, one of their first comedy specials, it may have been the first comedy special, I wrote that with him.
Okay.
It's called Jay Leno and the American Dream. And, you know, acted a little bit in that and wrote it with him and had a great time doing that. So I was sort of half over into the writing world with him.
Okay.
And then I met and was friends with guys like Dennis Miller, who I worked with on the Tribune show that was here in KTLA, and then the HBO show.
Okay.
And won a couple of Emmys with him.
What was that like? I mean, it's so funny. People were different how they were, like, the Emmys. Like,
yeah.
Do you know Tom Caltabiano?
I know the name.
He wrote for, he won two Emmys for Everyone Loves Raymond.
Mm-hmm.
But one's, like, on his bookshelf, and one's on his friend at his friend's deli in Buffalo.
Right.
It's like, he goes, I didn't like going to him because... He goes, we never thought we were going to win, and you're just sitting there, and you're waiting, and you're like, we're not going to win. What was it for you like to go to the Emmys? Were you excited? Was it cool? It was such a hip show, the Dennis Miller show, when it came out,
right.
And you guys won the Emmys your first 2 years, right?
Right.
But it didn't get canceled or something like that?
No, I went on, and, you know, Feldman was on it. He won three on that, I think.
Okay.
And, I went on to do some, I wanted to do some, I wanted to make some money, so I went into sitcoms.
Okay.
At that point, I got a John Mendoza had a show.
Okay, yeah.
So I went with him. Jim Vallely was working on a show called Golden Palace, and he brought me in there, my first job as a punch-up guy. And then I went over to John's show, and that got me to Castle Rock, and I got involved in a few things there and got a development deal and did some pilots and tried to get my own show on the air. So I didn't stay with Dennis. We had a little falling out over that book, The Rants, which I co-created with him. And then he was a little too demanding. He was getting that. And I said, I want to have a house, too.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I went over and did sitcoms, but that show went on for a few more years.
Okay. Were you still doing stand-up at the time when you started writing, or you just said, I'm just going to stick to the writing?
You know what? I stopped doing stand-up in 92.
Okay. You've already done the Tonight Show. I mean, it's like, it's when you stopped. It's not like you were someone who just goes, like I got out of the business for certain different reasons and I got back in it, but it's not like you just sat there. You had already been on the Tonight. It's like you had already had the credits, and you were just like, would you just get tired of it, or?
Well, you know what happened? Somewhere in 80, around 88, I think, you know, the comedy boom, all these booms, they go up and down.
Right.
Let's say, I was in Chicago, and Buddy Guy opened a blues club.
Okay.
The week I was there. And the opening night, it was Pat. He had everybody. He had B.B. King there. There's so many. Stevie Ray Vaughan, I think, was there. It was like one of these, you know, unbelievable lineups for the blues.
Yeah,
just and the
sick.
Club was jam-packed. You couldn't get in. So we thought, tomorrow, after the show, we'll go over to the blues club. And we did. And there was nobody there. Buddy Guy was there, but it was basically empty. It was like 20, 30 people. Because the blues, I remember in college, when in 67, 68, blues clubs, you couldn't get into them. And there was nobody playing it in there. It was just a blues band.
Right.
Just some guys playing 12 bar. It was just playing blues. And it was hilarious and fun, and it was packed. But then the blues, it didn't have that kind of a draw. It had to be the big stars. And I said, you know, stand-up feels to me like it's on the cusp of, you're going to have, there's so many clubs, in order to fill a club and really get something happening, you're going to have the biggest stand-ups in it.
Right.
Otherwise, they're going to have to, and they started that papering the rooms. And, you know, people weren't dying to go out to stand-up clubs in 1989, 90, 91. And it became very, also became kind of right-wing. When you go out into the country to work, it was much more of a Republican right-wing cheering kind of a thing of, you know, like, yeah, the hell with the poor. It was all, you know, that kind of stuff. So it wasn't even my sensibility anymore. And so when I got the opportunity to write, stop traveling all over the place, stay home, I just said, you know, I'm not gonna bother with the stand-up right now. I'm just going to do the writing and see where that takes me. So I had 12 years in stand-up. I stopped.
Okay.
And then the writing thing, I guess I worked up until 2009 or 10. The Brad Garrett show was the last one I worked on.
Now I'm
basically retired with that, too.
Okay, but now what was it weird for you? I mean, okay, now writing the jokes and writing for, like, the Dennis Miller show, I mean, that's normal.
Yeah.
I mean, and I've noticed that I've talked to a lot of comics who have become writers, is it's very hard. First of all, there's discipline. I mean, everyone thinks, oh, yeah, you're an entertainer. You know, how people are in the business.
Right.
They think, oh, first of all, they think, a lot of people think that the actors are making stuff up as they talk on a sitcom.
Exactly, right.
But a lot of people don't know. It's a long day. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, is that it's like, for a lot of comics, because you're used to working 45 minutes a night, two shows an hour, and then rest of the day, you're just hanging out, you do whatever.
Right.
First of all, did you know how to write a sitcom? I mean, because it's like you have to have the structure. I mean, did someone teach you, or you just, they threw you in, they said, here's,
you know, it's funny. I mean, I never really watched them much. When I was a kid, and I'm talking about, you know, 16, 15, I remember the Mary Tyler Moore show, and I remember MASH and Dick Van Dyke, watching some of those. And, you know, at dinner with the family, because you don't want to talk to your family. So we'd have the little TV there. But I wasn't immersed in television culture. And then I was in college a little bit. Then I was in the Army. When I got out of the Army, you're dating. You're out at night trying to intermingle and get laid, frankly.
Exactly.
You know, see, I'm not home watching sitcoms.
Right, right.
And then when you start writing sitcoms, you don't have time to watch sitcoms. I didn't want to work on a show all week and then watch it, too.
Right.
It just seemed pointless. And, you know, these little 20-minute periods of your life where you're going to go home on a Thursday and watch four or five shows. I never did that. So to answer your question, I didn't know how to write sitcoms, and I still don't.
Okay.
I don't know that it's a form I ever internalized or could feel. I can feel movies, but I can't. Sitcoms, they're, you know, they change the way that they pace them. It's, you know, the subject matter all seems to be the same to me, too. After a while, I mean, working on a variety show like with Dennis or Bill Maher, when I was working with him,
Oh, you worked at Politically Incorrect.
Yeah.
Okay.
And during, you know, in 9/11, those are exciting times to be on a variety show because you're writing material, you're putting it right in the mouth of a guy who really thinks and talks like you.
Right.
I mean, in my case, I could write for those guys because I wrote jokes that they liked. They liked what I did. I liked what they did. I didn't have to go put myself in a different head.
Right. Okay.
So that was
stuff
fun.
It's stuff you would have said.
I would have said it anyway.
Okay.
So it's like, yeah, I'll give it to him. Yeah, here's a joke. Here, you say this joke.
Okay.
You know, I give a joke to Dennis. I guess this was in 91 or 2. Is it that Pat Buchanan is so homophobic he blames global warming on the AIDS quilt? You know, that's something I would do in my
I'd
give it to him. And it works, and it gets applied. And you get kind of this nice contact high off of that work. And you're working with really funny guys at that time.
Well, the staff was great. I looked at the staff for 10 of them. I mean, it's like Cesario and Feldman, just Ed Driscoll, and just a bunch of people.
Greg Greenberg, Mike Dugan, a bunch of people. Yeah, but the other show, the one when I quit in 92, that show, the Tribune show, was Drake Sather, Nick Bakay, Norm MacDonald, John Rigi, Mark Brazil, who created the 70s show. Max Munchnick and Dave Cohan, who did Will and Grace. There was a bunch of guys who went on to some big stuff, and they were a good staff. And so if you spent your day talking to them and making them laugh, I had no real need to go down to a comedy club and get more laughs.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like
hang
I was talking
out.
About in the beginning. I wasn't in there for – I didn't go to the comedy club to just – I wasn't desperate to have more and more laughs. You know, like one set in New York was good for me.
Okay, you have to go like
jump
eight
in
sets.
Cabs and run all over town.
I see that out here now. Some of the guys like, it's my fifth stage tonight. I'm thinking, and this guy's not funny. So I'm thinking, well, maybe by the fifth one, you're going to laugh. You know, but I the same way you'd go in. It's like you're doing the same thing. You go up, you do your act.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, it's like now it's like people sit there. Like when I go back east, I perform. Mm-hmm. You know, I perform my hometown, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I perform. You know, in fact, people this weekend, I'll be at the Comedy Works in Bristol, Pennsylvania. It's 9 o'clock Friday and Saturday. It's a little plug there, my segue. But no, for me, it's fun because, you know, you go back and you go up and you do a 25 or 30 minute set. And it's an area I haven't been back to before I started dating this girl for a while. And so when you go up, there's people from your high school there that you haven't seen, and you can talk about how much the area's changed, and there's something, and you have 25 or 30 minutes. But out here, it's like, okay, you have 7 minutes. Someone's like, will you do our show in Santa Monica? Are you paying me? Well, no. I said, okay, well, I don't want to drive. It's okay, Santa Monica is 22 miles, so that means $4 up, $4 back. So I'm basically spending $8 to perform. I don't want to do that. And that's like, it's like people go, we'll do this show. It's like, why? No one's going to see you. You know, people think it's, and you do need the stage time, but no one sees you at bars, and bars don't really help your act much. I mean, they get you a little sharper if you go on the road, but it's just weird.
Well, you have stand-up, you can't do it. You can't Rupert Pupkin it. You know, you can't do it by yourself.
Right.
You can't practice scales by yourself. It's something you do in front of an audience. And, you know, my wife will say, you know, you should do that bit. All you're sitting around a table with some people at dinner or something and come up with something that people laugh at.
Right.
You go, you should do that. You should put it on stage. You go, but I don't do that anymore. I don't pull that bit out, shape it so that you can present it just naked to an audience.
Right.
Make it sense. And I'm going to drive down, get dressed, drive all the way down. So I'm going to hang around, go through the anxiety of waiting, going on, doing it. Then afterwards, having a drink and talking about it. You know?
Right.
It's like I understand that whole thing, but
you've been there, done that.
I don't want to drive an hour to do it. I don't, like you said, I don't want to go all over to... I'm home with the dogs now. We like to be in bed at 10:30. You know, I'm stand-up, I was always going on at 9, 10:30.
Right, yeah.
And you were awake till 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a weekend off for 6 years, and you're just used to that. Now it's like, I love when I go back and perform. It's a weekend in my hometown. Hey, it's something fun to do, you know? I sit there and I see guys that have been... Well, some guys have been doing the same act from, you know, 1988. And I'm like, God, I'm like, didn't you guys ever want to just get out of Philly? It was weird.
I love those guys. Can you imagine just only 30 years ago today, Nixon resigned? You know, so they're trying to set it to bring it forward to make it relevant. Somewhere.
I know. It's
But that's true. I just when I quit doing stand up, people would say after a few months ago, hey, what have you been doing? Are you, you know, you're working out? What do you, you seem good? Because it was like coming, I didn't realize it was coming out of a wind tunnel. You know, the whole stand-up career was like being in a wind tunnel.
Okay.
And you're leaning forward into it all the time. And you're always, even if it's just sort of subconsciously looking for material, got your ear out for a joke at something. Because I wouldn't write material. I don't sit down and write it.
Right.
I would be talking to people at a coffee shop or something, or usually complaining about something. You know, complaining about politics, complaining about what's going on. And you'd find, as you were talking, you'd find jokes.
Right.
You know, I tended to have jokes come out the way they're supposed to come out. I would say it the way it was supposed to be done. For some reason, I would just think that way.
Right.
So I would just go out, hang around, and try and keep track mentally, try and make of a note here and there, and try not to forget too much material, and try and put it together and just go on. And that was the work. But that daily thing of looking for it, going down to the comedy club at night, putting on the armor, you know, this is your performance shirt and pants, this is your, you know, shave. Hey, go down there, get in there, get in the mood. You got to jack yourself up a little bit. You can't just go on stage and talk. There's a performance level you have.
Right.
And so all that stuff, you don't realize what a kind of a strain it is. It's like driving a car at 100 miles an hour all day, you know. You relax into it. You know, if you're a professional driver, driving 150 is not any big
exactly.
deal. But when you stop driving 150, you don't realize, oh, my God, I can relax.
Right.
You know, I drive at 150 the way I'm supposed to, paying attention to everything. But when you stop it, you go, you know, actually, that was really stressful.
Yeah.
That's so just, you come out of that. And then you go into this other thing, these writing rooms where you're in there for 12, 15 hours a day.
So you started writing My Wife and Kids. That was your first sitcom?
No, the first sitcom was Golden Pals, which was the hilarious, I say hilarious with quotation marks. That was the one, the Golden Girls without Bea Arthur.
Oh, okay.
Where the women who couldn't afford not to live altogether in a house decided to buy a hotel.
Okay. So that's
they buy a hotel in Florida, in Miami. So that was the first room I was in. Then I went to John Mendoza. I had a show called The Second Half, which got canceled. Then I was sort of I had a deal at Castle Rock, so I was working on Naked Truth.
It's funny you say Naked Truth because Robbie Benson had directed a few episodes of that.
Yeah, after I was there.
Okay,
but I was there the first year, most of the first year, and then I did some pilots, and then. You know, a couple other shows. We wrote a couple of things with Larry Miller and a couple of things that didn't go. And then it's 2000, and I get out of there. I do a show called The Steven Weber Show, which was originally called Cursed. And after that, I went over to the Bill Maher Show. And then I was, had to sort of go through there. And then I did Damon Wayans' show.
Okay.
And then that sort of retired in 2005.
What was it like politically incorrect? Because back then you didn't see stuff like that then. And it was it was such a different format. And it was very highbrow. And I'm sure a lot of people didn't get it. But it was on network TV. Mm-hmm. And it was it actually made people aware of where it's like the late night shows. They hit the target, but they do a joke about it. But this was Maher would do his, dialogue, which was edgier than the late show guys. And then they would have guests just talk about it. I mean, was that just a weird experience because it was so new? I mean, it was.
No, it didn't seem new. I mean, Bill does a great job with that, but he'd been at it for a while. You know, it was a cable show before that, called Politically Incorrect, and then it moved over to ABC. And I had done it as a performer before it moved to ABC, and then worked on it with him. So I also knew him so well, it didn't seem... It was a funny McLaughlin report. You know, four people sitting around kicking around some ideas was not that shocking, but it was funny.
Right.
And it was supposed to be, they'd have a comic and a celebrity guest and maybe somebody who knew something or supposed to know something.
Right.
And it was a nice format. I think it was a good show. But it wasn't strange to me because Dennis's show was essentially, Dennis would have one guest. And I think, I always said to Bill, I think the reason we won Emmys on Dennis's show is there was more writing. You know, the rant that opened the show was a bigger piece, and then he'd have one guest talk about some stuff. Then he would have his, his picture desk, the news of the week kind of thing and jokes. So it was heavier with the writing. When you've got four people, the writing, you had some monologue, but it didn't feel different than, say, The Tonight Show, except all the guests were on at the same time.
Did the people know, are they versed how much before in the topics? Like, would they know, tonight we're going to do that? Did you say that when they say, okay, here's, if someone's come to my show, and I'd say, okay, today, because we just talked, that's my show. Right. But if I would say, hey, we're going to talk about this topic. Would that happen? So everyone with the four people?
Yeah, you'd say, we want to talk about Romney's blunder in England. We want to talk about Romney's blunder with the Middle East. We want to talk about Romney's latest blunder. And then we're also going to talk about what we think maybe Romney's next blunder is going to be. But it'll be all Romney blunder. I'm just kidding. But you'd say, here, we're going to talk about this. We want to talk about that. We also want to talk maybe a big movie's come out or something.
Okay.
Like that. So you get some topics so that you have something prepared.
Now, you've written for like you know, Dennis Miller Show on Politically Incorrect. You've written for some, you know, politically thoughtful shows. Are you very political in your real life? Do you have a lot of opinions? You kind of yourself, you know, have, I mean, was it, I can imagine, you know, writing jokes is jokes, but right. if you're writing some political joke, I mean, you have to have a pretty much a good knowledge of it. Have you been something, someone who followed politics all your life, or?
No, but I do get involved when I'm not doing anything else.
Okay.
It's one of those things that's a constant, you can find all kinds of things to write jokes about. But I'm not looking, it's funny, I don't actually write jokes, like, I've worked with people like Rita Rudner and other people who are very disciplined joke writers, and they'll say, let's sit down and write jokes today. Let's
right.
write jokes
that's
about.
Like Bill Kelly, who wrote, I don't know if you know Bill,
yeah.
but he wrote Politically Incorrect, and he yeah. would sit there, and in Philly, he would write, look yeah. at a word, flip it on. I can't write like that.
Let's write about fire departments. And I right. go, who cares about the fire
right.
department? I only write jokes that mean something to me. So politics has a built-in kind of a meaning. It's a low-grade meaning.
Okay.
It doesn't mean anything to you like your kids do.
Right.
I don't have any. I imagine like your dogs or anything real in your life.
Okay.
But it's got a low-grade meaning to it. Like, it could be something that could affect your life. So it's got a built-in kind of a zats in it. And people, you know, when you're working in the middle band of, you know, when you're working in a comedy club, you can only talk about things that most of the audience know.
Right.
So you got a restricted place to work anyway. You know, you could have a fantastic hunk on, you know, the day that T.S. Eliot wrote The Wasteland, what he was eating.
Right.
And why it was so... You know, I think he had a bad, you know, but you can't, people are going, what?
Yeah, oh yeah, well that's...
What are you talking about? So you've got this place to work, and politics is one of the things that most people, they watch the news, they have a few things they all know about. Like everybody knows about Kerry's, you know, everybody knows
right.
about Romney's thing. But it was funny, because when I was doing stand-up, it was a great place to get material, and material that people understood. So I did get into it, but I didn't understand it very
okay.
much. I just wrote jokes about what I was hearing and looking at on the news and headlines, right, that would be annoying or being talked about. Like I said, you go out and have a conversation, and people are talking about it, you write a joke about it
right.
in your head. But when I got out of it and went into sitcoms, I didn't think about politics.
Yeah, because you're
doing sitcoms. Now you're talking about characters. You're looking for jokes that are in character, about a story or something like that. And it's a different kind of writing. It's a little more involving. You're talking about psychology of an individual in a certain situation. It's different. And but when I got out of sitcoms and I get an offer to go, oh, why don't you, not the Weber Show, why don't you come over and work on a Bill Maher show? I go back into politics.
Right, okay.
And when I got back in, I realized it's the same. You know, great political jokes never change. Mark Twain's great political jokes, or Jonathan Swift's great, you know, political jokes, like in Gulliver's Travels, they never change, because politics really never changes.
Right.
The names change, but it's still somebody trapped in a well, or down there up a tree, or lost at sea. It's still this guy's lying, this guy's a cheat,
okay.
this guy's a dirtball. This one, you know, is a good guy who's been... unfortunately caught in flagrante delicto. And
right.
So that's never changes. And that gives you a weird attitude about politics, that this too will pass, you know? I mean, like, I think Romney's an idiot. But, you know, whatever happens, it'll pass.
Right. Well, I'm always what cracks me up about the politics is just that I just want to see someone one day just say, here's what I can do very well, not here's what he can't do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't give a crap what he can't do. I'm not going to vote.
Right.
I don't sit there and watch a sporting event and go, oh, you know, well, you can do this and you can't do this. And you know, and that's what always cracks me up. It's like, did you see the movie The Campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so like, what reminds me, like when Will Ferrell's sitting there going, you're the thing of my, you know, my backbone of my career. And then, you know, Filipino carnival workers are, and it's just, that's like, it's mm-hmm. it's such a show. It's like, it is like a pony show. I mean, people don't understand that, but it's just...
I don't think it's even as bad as it used to be, because the great thing now that like Romney doesn't seem to understand is we can go on our watch and we can look at something that you carry around
right.
and say, I wonder if he actually did that. And you can look it up. And this guy must think nobody records him. He's in a room with some people. He thinks he's safe. He doesn't know that there are little tiny recording devices, a little iPod you can hold up. I get the whole thing.
Well, then don't people think that just, okay, in these days, you're right, with all the technology, I mean, you can't go anywhere, and you're a public figure. I mean, you're the big story right now. I would not talk to anybody. I would have like people with metal wand, those things saying, right. okay, doo, 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 like the old school movies. Oh, wait, he's carrying, you know, something. But it's just so funny that people don't understand that.
No, a recording device. Hey, we have you on video.
Right.
You know, old time politicians, I'm sure, you know, they were many, many liars in that business, and every single one of them was like a stand-up would go, I am happy to be here in Kalamazoo, the greatest city in America. And they can't go the next day over to Flint and say, the greatest city, because they're going to have tape of you the last night.
Exactly.
So all these guys don't get that not only can you not go around and flatter everybody and tell every constituency what you're going to give them, even if it's not, even if it's what you told the other guys you weren't going to give them.
Right.
Because we can record it all. So it's, they're being forced, I think, into some better either message management or some modicum of honesty, because you're gonna, you can't just go around and lie.
You can't. I mean, that's the thing. It's like not like it's like so funny. And a lot of times, people are happier if you tell the truth. I mean, it's like with Will, what's his name, Marion Barry. I mean, the guy got caught smoking crack on tape with hookers in a room, and he got reelected.
Right.
So people are like, you know what? He's better than that guy. I smoke crack with hookers. Well, I'll vote for him. It's just so weird. But yeah, you can't. You have to watch. I mean, there, it's like with the old story about Jerry Springer when he was the mayor of Cincinnati.
Right.
He wrote a check to a prostitute.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they're going to find out. I mean, it's just so. Sometimes they're so stupid. There's so many. They're supposed to be so smart, but then they're so stupid.
Yeah, people who are very dumb about how things are going to play. You know, you can't say that. Well, what do you mean? What are you talking about? It's true. So, well, you can't say it like that.
Right.
You can't say 47% of Americans are deadbeats. Now, you're interpreting it that way. That's not the way it is.
Right.
And even if it were true, you can't say it.
Right.
You got to say, Americans, we've got a little bit of a weight problem in this country. Okay, everybody, even huge people go, yeah, he's not talking about me.
Right.
But we do have a little bit of a weight, my friend is a little overweight.
Well, you said that. It's so funny about the weight problem now. And as I said, since I had that heart thing, I had to watch my sodium.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're talking about that, but I saw this documentary, and it's called Fat Something and Nearly Dead. It's about a guy who was from Australia, and he had like an autoimmune deficiency, and he put a lot of weight on, and he said, I'm tired of being on these pills. So he sat there, and he just, for a month, he juiced, and he got healthy, and he's interviewing people who are heavy and who are 28, and he's like, so how, the way you're eating, how long do you expect to live till? They're like, I don't know, 35. I'm like, why, you're going to eat crap until you die a very early age. It's like what? Mm-hmm. What makes someone think like that?
Yeah, well, obviously, has no real reason to hang in there. I mean, it's not, a lot of people just go, hey, let's say I lose 300 pounds, so I'll be 300.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to get better looking. It's pointless. I'm not going to meet the guy I want. My dreams are impossible, and so those people just give up.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's sad to watch, but. It is hard to keep moving forward. I must say, you get to be a certain age. My dad died when he was 70, but I think that, in a way, he was probably just happier because he never could figure out a way to be older.
Okay.
He wanted to be younger. He wanted to be the 45-year-old virile, guy in the office that could, pick up a secretary here and there.
Right, yeah.
And he wanted to be that guy. He didn't want to be 80 years old. He didn't see a way to be 80 and be frail or be stumbling and fall down or have to have help or assistance or cut back on this and that. He was like me. He was borderline diabetic.
Okay.
But he would come into town. I knew he wasn't supposed to eat, desserts.
Right.
But we'd go to the Palm or something because he liked it over there, and he would sip at a cola because he was an alcoholic. He would suffer not drinking. But he would say, I'm going to have the cheesecake for dessert. I said, Dad, really? He says, I like it. I want it. I'm going to have it. He would get annoyed because he's like, he hated authority.
That's like
I hate authority. And I think it's authority.
Yeah, that's,
I think not being able to eat is being told not to do something.
Because
so I think if I go out myself where no one can see me and I eat a cheesecake, I got away with it.
Right. Well, it's funny because that's like my father. I mean, he went through a stroke, and we're at a restaurant in Delaware, and he's like, it's hot, and he can't get his zipper undone. And I go, well, Dad, let me do it for you. I'm not an invalid.
Yeah.
No, Dad, let me do it for you.
Yeah.
No, if I can't get it. Yeah. And I said, well, then don't sit here and bitch that you're hot.
Right.
So then funny thing is, when we finally got home, I could barely get it undone. He has, from the stroke, his hands screwed up like that. Right. I'm like, Dad, how did you even expect to do that? But he got so, don't make a scene. I'm not, and it's like, I'm like, right. Okay. Right. It's just so funny. As we get older, it's like my dad. It's like they They're like, I can do this. I can do this. And it's like, my God, you can't go mow the lawn. You're 87.
It's going to be terrible. There's one, but I'm saying, so you can either think it's going to be terrible or you can find some philosophy. We were talking earlier about men's fashion. You know, when you get to be in your 50s, you know, you're out of fashion.
Right.
There's no point putting fashion on you.
Right.
You might as well put, you know, nail clothes on a stick and, right. you know, sit them in the back of a bus. No one's going to look or care. You
right.
just get cheaper, nice, comfortable clothes. My fear is always ending up at 80 or something with clothes that don't fit. That's my big fear. You know, like a sweatshirt where the neck of the sweatshirt is cut wrong so it comes up on your Adam's
right.
apple. I can't stand that.
Yeah.
That's my biggest fear. I don't care about the cars or anything else. It's like clean place to live, nice little spot with a library card, pants that fit.
Right.
I don't want them hanging. I don't want them way up over my ankles.
Exactly.
Because I can't afford good pair
that's
of pants.
That's the thing, yeah. It's just so funny. That's that's with the clothing for me because I lost 20 pounds, which I was right. thin anyway. But all of a sudden, my girlfriend goes, are you wearing those jeans? And I go, I really like those jeans. She goes, yeah, but there were 2 inches more of your waist. You know, you always pull them up. I go, I pulled them up anyway because a lot of times these jeans are low. I'm not used to like this low riding.
The low thing, yeah.
And so, I pull them up just because I'm like, wait, I'm used to being higher, but it's true. It's finding clothes that fit. You have to feel comfortable in your clothes.
You got to fit. And you know what a revelation to me. And I must have been almost 50. My wife, I was dating her. She said, go to a tailor. I go, tailor?
Right.
You know, I would just buy clothes. You know, we'd buy them off the rack when I was a kid. And if they didn't fit, you suffered. If it was a little short in the sleeve, you suffered.
Exactly.
And I'm not built. You know, it's funny to realize that. And when I lived in Texas for a short period of time, I bought one of these shirts. It's like it's got a an embroidered sort of bib front. It's just
right.
Mexican sort of farm shirt.
I know exactly. Yeah,
I bought one, but the sleeves were to get the sleeves to fit. The body was gigantic, and you're buying it from a different
right.
group of people.
Right, right, right.
You know, now if I went to Ireland and I buy clothes off the rack, and they all kind of fit. It was
right.
it was weird because you're in
funny.
Your right spot. But, yeah, I didn't even realize you could have a tailor. Like, you buy the pants, you go, the leg's the right length, or the waist and everything's fine, but the pants are a little bit long.
Right.
And I was just not, before, you go, oh, I can't buy them. You go, what are you, high? Are you dumb? You go to a tailor.
Exactly, so funny.
$10.
We have, like, 3 minutes left.
Is okay.
Can people follow your work anywhere, or do you post stuff? Do you tweet? Do you do any of that stuff?
I do some tweeting, but it's very rare. I don't really even understand. I like sometimes the... You got to fit it into this.
That's what I was going to say. I love that because for me, it's like I always do, not bits, but things I think are funny.
Right.
And I always love, I think if for any comics out there listening, I think it really makes you a stronger writer because you have to sit there and go, okay, mm-hmm. I can't do all this expose. I have to figure out this word.
Yeah, I do think that's got a value,
okay.
writing in that thing. But when on Facebook, I like to let myself go. Sometimes it'll be a longer thing or just let myself have some
right.
fun writing.
Exactly, okay.
Okay, because it's not real writing. It's not like which I can't do for some reason. You can't just put the Facebook thing over there and then sit down and actually write for yourself.
Right.
You can't organize that. But this is a nice little place to chat. You know, to me, Facebook's like a party with your friends that's always happening.
Right, right, right.
And you step in and you can start making little jokes and pick up the thread of the conversation very easily. And you can step out. But that's what it is, and it's always happening. You can get up in the middle of the night.
Oh, yeah, that's always great.
So I do that a little bit and do a little bit of tweeting. But I'm not doing anything... I'm really not doing anything right now except putting a new roof on the house.
Well, that's all. Are you doing it yourself?
No.
I was going to say, because I mean, I can never do any of that stuff.
No, I go up there just to look. Just to look
right.
is dangerous. I trip and I'll be rolling down that roof and off the back of the barn fast.
Well, it's so funny when you say that you can get that done. It's like me. I mean, when my girlfriend comes out, I always get a cleaning lady.
Yeah.
And because I live by myself, and it's so funny because I was going to make my one room my office. It's just... It's got like all the boxes of appliances I bought in the closet
right.
in case I ever move.
Right.
And it's just, it's great when you sit there and go, wow, I can leave my house and come back in 3 hours and it's going to be beautiful. You know,
right.
I wash the sheets the day before and I make my bed. I saw them ironing the pillowcases.
That's nice.
And you're like, wow. I'm like, but I do it so funny because I try to keep clean.
Right.
I do. She comes out like every once every month and a half and I go, well, maybe I'm going to do that. But then like, no, I'm flying back then. So it's just weird. It's like the roof. You know, you want to make sure it's done well, but you don't want to do it.
When you're our age... You have to. I got married a few years ago. My wife now, she keeps me from becoming an eccentric. Like before I met her, I was 50, and I was starting to do things like the maid would make the bed.
Right.
And I would not sleep in the bed because I go, the bed's for when you have a guest, when you have a
That's
woman
funny.
Over. I would sleep on top in a sleeping bag.
You know, we have to wrap up. Thank you. That's something I would do. I do that. Yeah. When she comes, I go, okay, well, I know, because I don't want the bed to be dirty when she's there. So I'll sleep on top or I'll go downstairs and sleep on a couch that I stick to. And it's because it's hot out. I'm like, don't want to. Anyway, I want to thank you so much for coming on the
Steve.
Show.
Thank you.
People, just hit me an email, cooper@indy100.com. Listen to past episodes at coopertalk.net. And I put a lot of my one-line bits up on coopertalk.com. So check it out. And also, I'm on Stitcher Radio. You can find a bunch of past episodes of that. And people listening back east, listen to me on the Big Daddy Graham Show on Philadelphia. I'll be there at 3 in the morning, 12 o'clock my time out here. And I'll be in Bristol, Pennsylvania this weekend. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. You have a wonderful weekend.